Good. I think we're ready to begin. My name is Lucy Frost, and I'm delighted to welcome you all to this panel called Place and Identity. I'm the chair of the Tasmanian Book Prizes Committee, so I'm delighted to welcome three writers today who are all established writers, and they all have international readerships, a point to which I want to come back a little bit later in terms of place and the way place may affect their readers' reading of their books. So on my far left is Jonathan Ledgard, who has arrived from Africa yesterday, Catherine Scholes, and Ronald Wright. Now, I have always, until recently, thought of Ron as a novelist, but he has recently morphed into a nonfiction writer who's writing very exciting political commentary about where the world is going. And he is a nonfiction writer, and the other two are novelists. They have other hats also, but we're here to talk about their latest books, and their books are books of fiction. So I want to mention these books to start out with. So here's Giraffe, Jonathan Ledgard's book, Catherine's most recent novel, The Hunter's Wife, and Ron's What is America? So these are the books that I'm hoping that they will concentrate on today, although, of course, we'll get them to talk about their other books as they would like to do it. In thinking about the panel for today and about these three writers, one of the things that I noticed is that all of them are living in places that are far away from the places in which they were born. Jonathan was born in Scotland and lives in Africa. Catherine was born in Africa and lives in Australia. And Ronald was born in England, and he lives in Canada. Even better, since this is in a festival called 10 Days on the Island, they all have connections to islands. So Jonathan was born in the Shetland Islands, and Catherine, of course, lives in Tasmania, which is our own island, and Ron lives in an island off the coast of British Columbia. I don't know whether we can make anything of this, but it's a nice kind of synchronicity. So my idea is just to ask them to talk a little bit about the role of place in their work as a way of introducing themselves and their work. So you're the furthest away, so we might as well let you get started, Jonathan.
Place. I think having been born in the Shetland Islands to a sort of Norman English family, already place was a very definite thing. I don't know if anyone here has been to the Shetland Islands, but it's a very harsh, remote, extraordinarily beautiful, windswept place. It's rather like a sort of aircraft carrier with a deck of peat in the middle of the North Atlantic. We have, I think, about 8 trees and literally in the whole islands. So I think going up there for a while, then that sense of place has never left me. And obviously being back in Tasmania for the first time, not back, but being back on an island, I think all of us who grow up on islands, even if they're big islands like Tasmania, have a very distinct feeling about being surrounded by water, by being in a finite community where you just know more people, it's a little bit safer, it's a little bit more intimate. Sometimes you're more exposed than you want to be. But the sense of community is a lot stronger. So that was the initial sense of place. And then, of course, growing up, place then became a class thing because I got sent to boarding school in England. And then it became an intellectual thing because then I went to university in Scotland and then university in the States. And what really ruined me or made me, depending on your point of view, was, funnily enough, you know, for someone who's a complete bookworm, I have to say that Tintin, I don't know if anyone's ever... when I was about 12, I decided to become a foreign correspondent simply on the basis of the Tintin comic book series. And anyone who's read and loved Tintin, of course he has his detractors, and quite rightly so, but the one thing that Hergé did, which was extraordinary, was fill, especially the later books, the early books, you know, where a bit too political, but the later books filled them with a sense of place and identity, which was funny because Hergé never ever travelled at all, really. I mean, he used to go to Montreux and Switzerland, and but he certainly never went to Tibet or even the Balkans or Africa or anywhere, really. And yes, that was the sense of place. And I decided to become a foreign correspondent, and I was very, very lucky that I managed to achieve my twin ambition, which was to become a foreign correspondent in order to become a novelist. And so then place became constant. New places, almost a drug, really, of every week another country, every week another story, and I've been very, very lucky since then. And obviously now, when I think of place, it's always as an outsider, and always looking. Now I live in Kenya, so I'm always on the outside, always in the corner of the room, observing. And as a novelist, obviously that's a very good quality to have, is to be on the outside. But you do feel a wee bit of an exile in the end. And I definitely am with Robert Louis Stevenson when, Robert Louis Stevenson talked about the end of his life in the South Pacific, about how the curse of a Scotsman was always to be outside of Scotland, but thinking of the place, and you can never really go home again. Yeah, that's place for me.
Thank you, Jonathan. Catherine?
Well, I'm just starting work at the moment on my sixth novel, and so in preparation for today, I just cast my mind back over my previous five novels and just looked at the places that the stories are set. And the list includes Tanzania, India, the Sahara Desert, Ethiopia, Tasmania, USA, and Antarctica. And I've spent time in all of those locations except for the Sahara Desert, unless you count watching Bertolucci's fabulous film of The Sheltering Sky. Now, some of those places belong to me quite intimately, Tanzania and Tasmania particularly, but none of them belong to me completely. I was born in Tanzania, as Lucy has said, spent some time in England as a child, more time in Africa, short time in England, and then arrived in Tasmania. My father is Welsh, my mother is English, and our whole family very proudly call ourselves Australians, and in particular Tasmanians. So you might conclude from that in fact I write as a placeless person, and to some extent that's true. I'm what's called a third culture child. This species was identified by an American sociologist in the 60s. She wrote about it extensively, and people have been investigating us ever since. There are a number of qualities that will emerge in children who have been brought up in a foreign culture or several often. They absorb pieces of that culture. Then there's their parents' culture, which may or may not be their birth culture. And out of those combination of cultures, they actually evolve a third culture, which is very much their own, though shared to some extent by other third culture children. It does make us different. And when I read, for example, the work of someone like Tim Winton, I feel very, very different as a writer. Well, one would, him being a literary superstar and a surfer, and then there's the ponytail. But, seriously, there's that incredible sense of deep belonging that comes out of his work. You can just live and breathe that it's in his blood. And I certainly envy it as a writer and as a person, as a human. In Tasmania, I felt that when I read Catherine Lohmer's novel, The God in the Ink, and here was someone to whom Northwest Tasmania was deep in her veins. And quite clearly, that's a great thing for a writer to have. But displacement and the riches of a third culture is also a great asset for a writer. As Jonathan has said, you are an outsider always looking in, and you have to become a cultural chameleon. And I can tell you, when I arrived age 10 in Tasmania with a BBC accent and parents who were known as Mummy and Daddy and no knowledge of team sports whatsoever, it was a matter of playground survival to be able to observe the components of the culture in which I'd found myself and learn to become a mimic version of it very, very quickly. And, of course, there's no better training for a novelist than to become someone who has finely tuned skills of observation about how a society is working. So the main characters in my stories, as it turns out, are always outsiders looking in. The first novel I wrote was the main character is a boy from the Sahara Desert called Benny, who is struggling to come to grips with life in Melbourne, and it came out of work that I'd done with refugee children in Melbourne. In a way, I was writing about him because I wanted to write about my own sense of loss of homeland that was very potent to me ever since I left Africa at the age of 10. But I think I rightly felt that this was politically unacceptable to be a white missionary's daughter, and that it would be much more much safer to write about the experiences of a migrant child. And I think that when I eventually did come to write about my own cultural origins, and I wrote The Rain Queen, which is set on a medical mission in East Africa in the 60s, I did receive some criticism from Australian reviewers, which did suggest to me that, in fact, I was not a politically correct resident of the country. This was not a problem, of course, to my overseas markets, where the world was perhaps viewed a little differently. The interesting thing too was that when I finally decided to write about Tasmania, and that was my novel The Stone Angel, and that was where I began, I said, this is my next thing, I'm going to now write my Tasmanian novel. It's almost all Tasmanian. I confess the first chapter is in Ethiopia, but the rest of it is in Tasmania. But once again, my main character is the daughter of an English migrant family, so I still didn't feel I could ever really write from inside the head of the born and bred person who belongs somewhere. And choice of character for me is important because I usually write my stories from only one person's point of view, which probably comes from my filmmaker's training, that I don't use the God narrative perspective in my work. So I really have to be able to live and breathe that person. And so for me, it's natural that they should be an outsider. One of the things that I wanted to do for this panel was find out something new about myself. And I did, because I looked into some of the academic writing about third culture children, and one of the things they mentioned was that they develop there is a very high level of interdependence within the family, because of course the family is the only constant that you've had in your life, and that children in particular will seek a long-standing and ongoing engagement with their parents, and that's certainly been true of me. And of course, this is all well and good in a healthy and functional family, but we're all well aware of the literary archetypes of the dysfunctional third culture family. Of course, the ultimate example well known would be the Poisonwood Bible, but Paul Theroux's The Mosquito Coast is another. And this is something that people do understand about third culture children. I have an incredibly positive, but probably slightly obsessive relationship with my family, I'm thinking, as a result of having thought this through. And all of my writing is completely concerned with family. And I always have to bring people back together. I cannot bear final partings, and I cannot bear final breakdowns between people. And I don't mind that reviewers will sometimes say that it's unrealistic and whatever, because, well, I don't care, because I've got to write it, and I just, it's too sad otherwise. Third culture children, of course, have experienced loss at an early age. It's often that grief has not been addressed purely by nature, the fact that you are a child. Maybe now there's more understanding of how such things might affect a child, but in the 60s and 70s, we were just expected to get on with life. And I find that wellspring of kind of grief and loss is something that I can draw upon and translate into other life experiences that I haven't had. And the other thing, of course, necessarily a third culture child from the very beginning of their lives has a genuine understanding that other lives, other ways of life and other landscapes actually really do exist. Of course, our most famous member of our tribe at the moment is the new American president, and people have talked a lot about the fact that he's not only of mixed parentage, but he's lived in Kenya, he's lived in Indonesia, he's written about these experiences in his own writings, and some have said, you know, maybe that's why he is the person who might be needed in the world now, that he's got this kind of global, a more global mindset, you know, which could well be the direct result of his origins. But so I'll stop there. I think I've probably said enough.
Thank you very much, Catherine. This is an opportunity for us to hear from Ronald Wright. And we want to hear what you have to say about place, but do you want to respond to Catherine's comment about those about Barack Obama as a third culture child and the implications of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've read Dreams from My Father, which is not only very well written, but I think not only very well written, but explores this whole thing of identity. I mean, not only is he half Kenyan, but he's also part Cherokee on the American side, which is quite interesting and in some ways representative of the American mix. But yeah, it's that outsider perspective that perhaps gives him the confidence, the appeal to the outside world, and the ability to break out of some of the very limiting American cultural patterns. I mean, George Bush famously, I don't think, ever went anywhere, really, until he became president. And I believe only something like 1 in 8 Americans holds a passport. Speaking of islands, the American Indians, the North American Indians, the indigenous people of North America, used to call North America this great island. When I wrote What is America, I asked a few trusted and very loyal friends to read it. And one of them was an American novelist friend. And he said to me, he says, I don't think people realize just how much we live here in the States on a great island. And I certainly have always felt that when traveling in the United States, even though it is the world's lone superpower, even though it is the modern empire, it has a very, very limited sense of the outside world. And that's why, and even though as a foreigner, you find it hard to get news. I mean, maybe it's a little better now with the internet, but before that came along, you know, trying to find a newspaper that actually told you anything about something other than the local sports teams or, you know, an axe murder in a trailer park was pretty difficult, with the exception of New York, perhaps, and one or two other big city newspapers. Because those are not national papers. So the country is insular, and I, like you, I believe and hope that Barack Obama will be able to break out of that pattern. Certainly, he obviously has personally, but whether he can take his country there remains to be seen. But that insularity, I think, is also a feature of imperial powers. Because I grew up in England, Canadian father, English mother, grew up in England, which is a very small, I mean, Britain, very small island, but it thinks it's the center of the world. It certainly still did when, in the 1950s, when I was growing up, the British Empire was slowly self-destructing at that time, but everybody still sort of believed in the British Empire and felt that Britain was the center of the world and the best possible place. And so there was this sense of insularity, but no sense that it mattered. And that, I think, is where the United States is now, although I think it is perhaps more deeply rooted in the American cultural pattern because of the way in which American culture was forged on the frontier out of contact with the rest of Western civilization, whereas Britain at least kind of belonged to Europe, even though it saw most Europeans as enemies. As for myself, yeah, apart from growing up in Britain, strange sort of upbringing, like Jonathan, went to a number of boarding schools, most of which were rather bad, and one of which I was invited to leave.
What did you do?
Well, come to that later. At the same time, my parents were very restless souls. My father was always trying to find a landscape like the interior, the wide open spaces of the interior of British Columbia in southern England, which is rather difficult. My mother liked to be able to walk to the shops, never learned to drive. So they could never agree on where to live. And by the time I left home at 18, they had moved a dozen times. And that's not an exaggeration. So when people say, where are you from in England? I haven't a clue. I have no answer for that. What broke this sense of insularity for me was also, like Jonathan, again, reading a book at that sort of formative age, 12, 13, when your mind's just beginning to grow up. And in my case, it was also young adult literature, something that nobody would remember today, but there was a Victorian writer, W.H.G. Kingston, who lived in Peru in the 1860s. He was a trader there. And he wrote a number of adventure books for boys. And I just happened to stumble across this old Victorian boys' novel in the school library when I was about 13. I read it. And it was fascinating because it was about the last great Inca revolt in Peru, a time when a descendant of the ancient Inca kings in 1780 tried to kick out the Spaniards, and it actually was the beginning of the end of the Spanish Empire, because after he came quite close to succeeding, and that made the white Creoles in all what are now the Latin American republics realize that if they didn't take over from the metropolitan Spain, the Indians would take the country back, and that would be terrible for them. Anyway, the revolt of the last Inca king, Tupamaru, was still in living memory when Kingston was living in Peru. There were still a few old men who could talk about it, and he wrote a very evocative book, very dated, of course, but I've since gone back and reread it. But still, what it did was open me up to a place I'd never heard anything about. British education did not include South America. It just wasn't there. I didn't know where Peru was, never really heard of the Incas. And I became very much intrigued by that. And to make a long story short, it led me to study archaeology at university and then to travel to Peru. And my first book was a travel book, in the sense of a sort of literary travel book, about Peru. It was called Cut Stones and Crossroads, and it's now, I'm sure it's not in print here. It is still in print in some places, but not many. And so my first three books were travel books. I wrote one on the Maya, which is easier to find, called Time Among the Maya, and one on Fiji, actually, because it seemed to me that Fiji was an interesting anomaly in the history of imperialism, in the sense that the British had reined themselves in and from alienating the natives' land. But that's another story. And then from their history, and two novels, one of which deals with some of the South Pacific Islands and West Africa to a certain extent, and the other is set in Britain in the far future, after our civilization has collapsed because of our own folly.
And that is a novel which I found so disturbing. You create a place there that is Britain, but not Britain, in a sense that it, because it's in the future.
Well, yeah, and again, I think we've all been talking about how we almost need to be outsiders to write about places. Julian Barnes put it very well, where he said that the writer has to be universal in sympathy and an outcast by nature, because only then can he see clearly. I certainly feel that's true. And in trying to sort of picture, this was a sort of ecological, it's called a scientific romance, and it's an ecological dystopia, sort of a nightmare future intended to be a warning against our folly that we all clearly recognize now. To picture that, by going into the distant future, the main character is an archaeologist sort of catapulted 500 years in the future and then digs through the remains of Britain. And England is completely uninhabited. There are a few people left in Scotland, you'll be glad to hear. And he's trying to find out what went wrong. And, of course, it all has happened centuries in the past. He never really gets the answers. The idea really is to make the reader think about how this might have happened. But being an exile from England made it much easier to write that book, because the real England was long gone from my own experience, in a sense.
That's very interesting. Jonathan, when you were talking about place before, one of the places that you didn't mention was Czechoslovakia. Mm. And when I read Giraffe, I was actually astonished to discover that most of it is set in Czechoslovakia. I wasn't surprised that it began in Africa, because that's where I would expect a novel called Giraffe to begin. But for it to go almost immediately to Czechoslovakia was an unexpected turn of events. So it's set mostly in the mid-1970s, when you pretty obviously were not there. What lies behind this?
Well, my wife is Czech, and I was the Eastern Europe, well, actually nowadays we have to say Central Europe, correspondent, bureau chief for The Economist, and I was based in Prague. Rather like what Ron was saying about Latin America being off the British map. And in fact, even more interestingly, I think, Austro-Hungary was definitely off the British map. I mean, I went to graduate school in history. I mean, I had a lot of history, but I knew nothing when I pitched up in Prague about Austro-Hungarian history. I knew Kafka, who is pretty much irrelevant to Czechs. I mean, and the only way in I found was through, you know, the revolutions of 1848, national romantic movement, Walter Scott, That was the only way. And then, of course, through classical music, through Dvorak and Janáček and so on, I finally got a way in. And then I wanted to understand this place because this is a landlocked country. It's in the middle of Europe and has no wind. The wind never, ever blows in Bohemia. And I am used to the Atlantic. I'm an Atlantic person. You go between Britain and New York City, or you go to Ireland, you go to Iceland, you go down to the Caribbean, and even parts of Africa. It's an Atlanticist mindset. And to get dropped into that place was really, even after all the other countries I've been to, was pretty difficult for me because it was quite evidently European. It wasn't German. You know, it was a strange place. And then, on layered on that, in a sort of archaeological sense, was communism. Really trying to get your head around the understanding of a captive nation. So Giraffe was based on a true story that was originally told to me by a former SGB secret police officer. And the story is about how the secret police went to East Africa in the late 60s and early 70s and gathered more giraffes, captive giraffes, than have ever been captured before for at least for a zoo, and shipped them back behind the Iron Curtain and then shot them all dead in 1975 and then covered it up as a national secret. And the file is still lost, even what now we are 28 years after the, 18 years after the end of communism. It was a strange, strange, bizarre story. And so my novel was really about identity in a large sense, identity as a human being versus a wild animal. And then, the captivity of the animal in a zoo, and then the captivity of the people in a state. So yeah, that was, of course now we talk about the Czech Republic, Slovakia having divorced, but yeah, it was really a place as coming to terms with something I didn't understand at all. And because I had married into it and have now hybrid fifth culture children really, because they speak, you know, English, Czech, Swahili, you know, so they've got all of these things going on. So, but then I felt the need to try and understand it and come to terms with it.
I think that I better, as promised, offer an opportunity for other people to ask questions.
My question is specifically to Ron, and the fact that you have been living in Canada for so long, does that give you a sense of perspective in being able to write about the United States, as you've just done in your most recent book, and to a degree in A Short History of Progress, rather than having been entirely within the American culture?
I was sort of trying to follow in Tocqueville's footsteps, and what Tocqueville, you know, the great French political pioneer, political scientist who traveled in the early United States in the early 1830s, says in his, I think it's in Democracy in America, if not in his journals, that there are certain truths that the Americans, he says the whole society is engaged in the practice of self-praise, and there are certain truths that the Americans will only learn from experience or from outsiders. But I wasn't really writing the book for Americans, and I didn't really expect Americans to read it. I mean, Canadians would not read a critical book about Canada written by an American, so I never really thought that. But essentially, what made me want to write the book was I could not understand what Tony Blair thought he was doing. That was the sort of the little spark. I thought, doesn't he realize that when you have people that I saw, it was clear to me, were extremists, political extremists, and catering to religious fundamentalists, and people so far, you know, as further on the right than in any Western democracy since 1945, that you can't really deal with, and not even legitimately elected, you can't really deal with a regime like that as if they're speaking the language of modern diplomacy. So I was appalled when Blair went into, you know, got so far into bed that he went to Iraq and actually aided and abetted the campaign of misinformation that led to that. And I thought, doesn't Blair, and he got nothing for it, absolutely nothing. And I thought, doesn't Blair realize what he's dealing with? And it occurred to me that really the Brits don't understand America because they deal only with educated Americans who do have passports. They think it's that, you know, they think of America as a bigger, richer England. Whereas having lived in Canada all this time, I've always felt that it's a very, once you get away from the people who have passports, you're in a very strange and foreign country, something quite that I've not really experienced anywhere else. So the other thing that fed into this book was reading the pioneer American historian Frederick Jackson Turner, who in 1893 gave a paper which is known as the Frontier Thesis. And he put his finger right on what it is that makes the interior of America, the hinterland or the states who vote for Bush for the right-wing Republicans, the religious right-wing, isolated, very insular, the interior of that great island. He said it's that culture is the product of the frontier. And, of course, that was still almost going on when he wrote that. The frontier didn't officially close until 1890 with the massacre at Wounded Knee. But what he meant, I think, was that you had a three-century war zone in which the colonists were essentially out of control, first of all from the metropolitan power of Britain and its representatives, and then from the secular utopia dreamed up by the founding fathers. The people out on the frontier were uneducated, tended to belong to strange religious sects, had this constant xenophobia reinforced by fighting the indigenous people all the time, who quite rightly resisted their incursions. And this developed a sense of being in touch with God, carrying out his work, killing savages who were seen as Satan's minions. And then that language comes back with George Bush. You know, it's the war of good against evil. If you're not with us, you're against us. It's that Puritan thing actually sort of metastasized across the entire continent on the frontier. And I felt that most people who deal with the other side of America, which I call Enlightenment America in the book, unless they've traveled there and really got into it, have no idea that's there. But we have to deal with it as a world, the outside world, because America's a democracy and that half of America gets to elect the administration quite often.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with anything you say, Ron, but I feel sort of a strange twinge whenever George Bush is mentioned, because I was sent for 3 years of my life to Austin, Texas, by The Economist. This was 97, because we thought that George Bush might run for president. So I got to know him very well, and used to travel with him a lot, and you know, Karl Rove and all those guys. So I saw the whole fetal state of the Bush administration, as it were. But what the point I wanted to make was slightly different, which is, I think, first of all, it's wrong to talk about Puritan. Basically, we'd be all right if we were talking about Puritan America, you know. We're talking about Baptist America, you know, which is, and people who know in the mid-19th century, the Baptist movement split between the Southern Baptists and the Northern Baptists, who basically don't really exist anymore. They were absorbed into Methodists and Episcopalians and so on. And the frontier was always a lot more nuanced. I mean, I give just one example. In a place in Texas called Utopia, funnily enough, is one of only two places in the United States where the flag flies perpetually at half-mast, where it's under federal law mandated to fly at half-mast. The other is over Lincoln Memorial. And this place was a bunch of atheist Germans who were sent to the frontier after the 1848 revolution, free thinkers, they called themselves. They were the free thinker movement. And they resisted the Confederacy during the Civil War, and they were all slaughtered, all the entire community, the men, women, and children. And I was brought back to the whole sort of, you know, Austin, the capital of state of Texas, was a German-speaking city until the end of the First World War. It wasn't until Teddy Roosevelt, with his incredibly xenophobic campaign, barnstorming around America. I mean, the daily newspapers were German. They were very sophisticated. So I was thinking there must be more than just a frontier question. And to me, the defining point about the United States, and it's what, with my limited understanding of Australia, that Australians have this a little bit, is a strong sense of narrative, of unchallenged narrative. And that the better your story is, and the more you say it, the truer it becomes. And this is very distinct from Canada or even from Britain, you know, where narratives are always nuanced. You couldn't have a national narrative of Canada. Well, you could. It would be rather convoluted, you know. And similarly with Britain, people are always jumping up and saying, well, I know. So to me, the frontier narrative is very American in that sense. I mean, it's in a way, by pushing just a frontier narrative, then you're buying into what is fundamentally American. Does that make sense?
But what I'm talking about is not the romantic frontier. It's not the place of heroic pioneers taming the wilderness. That is the national myth. The real frontier is a zone of cultural interaction. It perhaps has more in common with the experience of the Boers in the interior of southern Africa, a group of Europeans with an Old Testament fundamentalist view of their own place in history. They called themselves Latter-day Saints. I mean, the Mormon Church is one of the offshoots of that Puritan diaspora, of which there are a legion and a number of sects. And that's one that happened to do particularly well. The Puritans saw themselves as Latter-day Saints in a promised land given to them by God. Ergo, anyone who was against them was evil and in league with the devil. And that sort of wasn't long before that extended to rival Puritans, too. But in the frontier, at the same time, the other thing to remember about the frontier is the myth says that the frontiersmen carved it out of the wilderness. The reality was the process was almost, most of the time, was parasitic. What the white Americans were doing was dispossessing the Native Americans. And what makes it very different from Australia is that they were able to take over the indigenous technology. They took over the indigenous farming system, lock, stock, and barrel, corn. All the other New World crops, potatoes, of course, the hunting methods. The white frontiersmen dressed like Indians, hunted like Indians, and fought like Indians, even to the point of scalping each other during the Civil War. And they acquired a great deal of the indigenous material culture, but did not acquire, again, it was a very unnuanced, they got a very sort of stripped-down version of it. Just as they were left with a very stripped-down version of the culture their ancestors had left behind, they acquired really only the material culture of the Indians without acquiring the spiritual connections with the land and the sense of belonging to place, because the frontiersmen were more than happy to keep moving on. But it was essentially a parasitic process, and that is thrown into the sharpest relief with the dispossession of the civilized tribes. So these were the eastern Indians, very numerous people who'd always lived in towns and had big cornfields and actually built great big pyramids. And these people were told that they would be allowed to coexist with the early United States if they became civilized. In other words, if they adapted to Euro-American culture as it then was. And they did this. I mean, the Cherokees ended up with a newspaper, a Supreme Court, a properly constituted state, which was recognized as a sovereign independent nation by the U.S. Supreme Court. But their very success doomed them because they had created an estate ready for the whites to move into, lock, stock, and barrel. And so they were eventually pushed across the Mississippi in the worst act of ethnic cleansing ever carried out by a democracy, it's been suggested, I think perhaps rightly, along with all the other Eastern Indians, almost all of them. And then the whites took over. So when I'm talking about frontier, I'm not talking about what the general understanding of frontier as enshrined in Hollywood westerns and the novels of Carl May implies.
Another opportunity to people.
What the hell had the Okpu in mind about these giraffes?
The communist state was all about volume, you know, and units of volume. So there was a chap called Carl Wagner who ran a zoo in the northern part of what is now the Czech Republic on the German border. And he wanted simply to have the largest collection of giraffes in the world. And he had some friends in the Politburo who said, okay. And rather bizarrely, it still does. Obviously, the giraffe numbers have diminished. But it still has the largest, I mean, the northern white rhino, which is the one from Tanzania, it has over half of the world's living northern white rhinos still in that zoo. It's very bizarre.
I guess the next part of the question is, so why do they kill them all? But perhaps in answering my other question, you can come to that, unless you want us all to buy the book and find out. But I think always when writers are on the stage, somebody has to ask the question about where do your ideas come from, and so I've given myself that role. I wanted to ask you about when you heard that story, that astonishing story about going and collecting them all and then killing them secretly, and then the economist sends you to Africa and you live in Africa. I'm interested in the process by which this book emerges. Does, from the moment that you heard the story, did you say to yourself, "There it is, right? You know, there is this novel that will get me into understanding the Czech," or did it come as a result of going to live in Africa? How is this kind of wonderful set of circumstances come together in this book for you?
It was actually more strange than that. Of course, when I heard the story, I thought that would make an amazing article for the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly, which is the magazine I write for. As soon as I started doing the research on it, I realized that was the novel for me, because it was dealing with all those questions of identity and taking things which are very familiar, like a giraffe. You wouldn't believe it, but I guarantee every one of you in this room, if you give yourself 2 or 3 days in Hobart, you'll see an image of a giraffe somewhere, in a shop, a magazine. And it's not something, you could supplant that with rhino or tiger or whatever. It's just when you meditate. But anyway, I actually wrote the novel in Afghanistan when I was a terrorism correspondent for the Economist. The really weird thing was that I didn't go to Africa. My editor called me the day after I gave the manuscript to my agent and said, "Would you like to go to Africa?" And and I said Kenya. He said, "How do you know?" Just the wild guess. And so I remember with my wife, when we actually went on our first safari there, it was incredibly moving to me, because I'd only seen giraffes in captivity, and the first time I saw a giraffe running free, which I'd written this whole novel about, was obviously a very moving experience. So it was all kind of back to front, really.
I've been fascinated at you in your discussions of place, and you've touched on it very sensitively, I think, and thank you for that. My question is to do with Australia's Indigenous people and their sense of place. I guess all of you are coming from a certain place, which may be third culture, or it's the culture you grew up in as children. But none of you have really written about the Indigenous people in a novel sense about your place, have you?
Not written about Australian Indigenous people, but I have written about the experience of the Indigenous people of the Americas in several books, particularly a book called Stolen Continents, which came out on the 500th anniversary of Columbus's 1492 voyage. So in 1992, it occurred to me that nobody had ever listened to the other side of the story. It wasn't that the Indigenous people hadn't told it or that it wasn't recorded, because in actual fact it was, in fragments anyway, but it just had never been heard. I mean, nobody seemed to know that the Emperor of Mexico, Montezuma, or Moctezuma, as he's called in Mexico, his grandson wrote 2 histories of the conquest of Mexico. Many of the Aztecs who fought Cortez dictated their memoirs in the Aztec language, and that is actually the earliest written historical record of the battles from either side, except for Cortez's official letters to the King of Spain, which were clearly massaged. For example, the Inca Emperor Atahualpa, overthrown by Pizarro, his nephew wrote the only autobiographical account of the conquest of Peru from either side. So that's where it starts. And then I followed 5 peoples, those 2, the Aztecs and the Incas, plus the Maya, the Cherokee, and the Iroquois, followed these fragments of their stories through from the 16th century. I couldn't get as far back as 1492, but I could start around 1520 with the Aztecs. From that period up until 1990, when the Mohawks, who are Iroquois, I'd already written most of the book by that point, but there was a Mohawk uprising, and the Canadian Army brought out tanks and soldiers. First time the Canadian Army had been mobilized against Indigenous people in 100 years. Which made the point, I think, to me, which I had sort of believed in when writing the book, but it made the point to everybody that this is unfinished history. The Americas is the only part of the world that's never been decolonized. Until very recently, there was no indigenous heads of state in any American nation, no American native language used at the national level. The white settlers never left, and they and the mixed people created these states. And the original people, who are still there in large numbers, are effectively captive nations within their own countries. So I have written about that. It's a very different experience from Australia in many ways, but I think it's something that people who live in the Americas, you know, needed to know.
Thank you very much. We could certainly go on, and I'm sorry that we don't have more time, but if I could ask you to join with me in thanking our three wonderful writers.